My guru finally spoke with solemn unction. Lahiri Mahasaya resurrected one of my friends from the dead. The young lads at my side smiled with keen interest. There was enough of the boy in me, too, to enjoy not only the philosophy but, in particular, any story I could get Sri Yukteswar to relate about his wondrous experiences with his guru. My friend Rama and I were inseparable, Master began. Because he was shy and reclusive, he chose to visit our guru Lahiri Mahasaya only during the hours of midnight and dawn, when the crowd of daytime disciples was absent. As Rama's closest friend, I served as a spiritual vent through which he let out the wealth of his spiritual perceptions. I found inspiration in his ideal companionship. My guru's face softened with memories. Rama was suddenly put to a severe test, Sri Yukteswar continued. He contracted the disease of Asiatic cholera. As our master never objected to the services of physicians at times of serious illness, two specialists were summoned. Amidst the frantic rush of ministering to the stricken man, I was deeply praying to Lahiri Mahasaya for help. I hurried to his home and sobbed out the story. The doctors are seeing Rama. He will be well. My guru smiled jovially. I returned with a light heart to my friend's bedside, only to find him in a dying state. He cannot last more than 1 or 2 hours, one of the physicians told me with a gesture of despair. Once more I hastened to Lahiri Mahasaya. The doctors are conscientious men. I am sure Rama will be well. The master dismissed me blithely. At Rama's place I found both doctors gone. One had left me a note, "We have done our best, but his case is hopeless." My friend was indeed the picture of a dying man. I did not understand how Lahiri Mahasaya's words could fail to come true, yet the sight of Rama's rapidly ebbing life kept suggesting to my mind, all is over now. Tossing thus on the seas of faith and apprehensive doubt, I ministered to my friend as best I could. He roused himself to cry out, "Yukteswar, run to Master and tell him I am gone. Ask him to bless my body before its last rites." With these words Rama sighed heavily and gave up the ghost. A cholera victim is often rational and fully conscious right up to the moment of death. I wept for an hour by his beloved form. Always a lover of quiet, now he had attained the utter stillness of death. Another disciple came in. I asked him to remain in my house until I returned. Half dazed, I trudged back to my guru. "How is Rama now?" Lahiri Mahasaya's face was wreathed in smiles. "Sir, you will soon see how he is," I blurted out emotionally. "In a few hours you will see his body, before it is carried to the crematory grounds." I broke down and moaned openly. "Yukteswar, control yourself. Sit calmly and meditate." My guru retired into Samadhi. The afternoon and night passed in unbroken silence. I struggled unsuccessfully to regain an inner composure. At dawn Lahiri Mahasaya glanced at me consolingly. "I see you are still disturbed. Why didn't you explain yesterday that you expected me to give Rama tangible aid in the form of some medicine?" The master pointed to a cup-shaped lamp containing crude castor oil. "Fill a little bottle from the lamp, put 7 drops into Rama's mouth." "Sir," I remonstrated, "he has been dead since yesterday noon. Of what use is the oil now?" "Never mind, just do as I ask." Lahiri Mahasaya's cheerful mood was incomprehensible. I was still in the unassuaged agony of bereavement. Pouring out a small amount of oil, I departed for Rama's house. I found my friend's body rigid in the death clasp. Paying no attention to his ghastly condition, I opened his lips with my right finger and managed, with my left hand and the help of the cork, to put the oil drop by drop over his clenched teeth. As the 7th drop touched his cold lips, Rama shivered violently. His muscles vibrated from head to foot as he sat up wonderingly. "I saw Lahiri Mahasaya in a blaze of light," he cried. "He shone like the sun. Arise, forsake your sleep," he commanded me. "Come with Yukteswar to see me." I could scarcely believe my eyes when Rama dressed himself and was strong enough after that fatal sickness to walk to the home of our guru. There he prostrated himself before Lahiri Mahasaya with tears of gratitude. The master was beside himself with mirth. His eyes twinkled at me mischievously. Yuxwar, he said, surely henceforth you will not fail to carry with you a bottle of castor oil. Whenever you see a corpse, just administer the oil. Why, 7 drops of lamp oil must surely foil the power of Yama. Guruji, you are ridiculing me. I don't understand, please point out the nature of my error. I told you twice the drama would be well, yet you could not fully believe me, Lahiri Mahasaya explained. I did not mean the doctors would be able to cure him, I remarked only that they were in attendance. There was no causal connection between my two statements. I didn't want to interfere with the physicians, they have to live, too. In a voice resounding with joy, my guru added, always know that the inexhaustible Paramatman A can heal anyone, doctor or no doctor. I see my mistake, I acknowledge remorsefully. I know now that your simple word is binding on the whole cosmos. As Sri Yuxwar finished the awesome story, one of the spellbound listeners ventured a question that, from a child, was doubly understandable. Sir, he said, why did your guru use castor oil? Child, giving the oil had no meaning except that I expected something material and Lahiri Mahasaya chose the nearby oil as an objective symbol for awakening my greater faith. The master allowed Rama to die, because I had partially doubted. But the divine guru knew that inasmuch as he had said the disciple would be well, the healing must take place, even though he had to cure Rama of death, a disease usually final. Sri Yuxwar dismissed the little group, and motioned me to a blanket seat at his feet. Yogananda, he said with unusual gravity, you have been surrounded from birth by direct disciples of Lahiri Mahasaya. The great master lived his sublime life in partial seclusion, and steadfastly refused to permit his followers to build any organization around his teachings. He made, nevertheless, a significant prediction. About 50 years after my passing, he said, my life will be written because of a deep interest in yoga which the West will manifest. The yogic message will encircle the globe, and aid in establishing that brotherhood of man which results from direct perception of the One Father. My son Yogananda, Sri Yuxwar went on, you must do your part in spreading that message, and in writing that sacred life. 50 years after Lahiri Mahasaya's passing in 1895 culminated in 1945, the year of completion of this present book. I cannot but be struck by the coincidence that the year 1945 has also ushered in a new age, the era of revolutionary atomic energies. All thoughtful minds turn as never before to the urgent problems of peace and brotherhood, lest the continued use of physical force banish all men along with the problems. Though the human race and its works disappear tracelessly by time or bomb, the sun does not falter in its course, the stars keep their invariable vigil. Cosmic law cannot be stayed or changed, and man would do well to put himself in harmony with it. If the cosmos is against might, if the sun wars not with the planets but retires at little time to give the stars their little sway, what avails our mailed fist? Shall any peace indeed come out of it? Not cruelty but goodwill arms the universal sinews, a humanity at peace will know the endless fruits of victory, sweeter to the taste than any nurtured on the soil of blood. The effective League of Nations will be a natural, nameless league of human hearts. The broad sympathies and discerning insight needed for the healing of earthly woes cannot flow from a mere intellectual consideration of man's diversities, but from knowledge of man's soul unity, his kinship with God. Toward realization of the world's highest ideal peace through brotherhood may yoga, the science of personal contact with the divine, spread in time to all men in all lands. Though India's civilization is ancient above any other, few historians have noted that her feat of national survival is by no means an accident, but a logical incident in the devotion to eternal verities which India has offered through her best men in every generation. By sheer continuity of being, by intransitivity before the ages, can dusty scholars truly tell us how many question mark India has given the worthiest answer of any people to the challenge of time. The biblical story of Abraham's plea to the Lord that the city of Sodom be spared if 10 righteous men could be found therein, And the divine reply, I will not destroy it for Ten's sake, gains new meaning in the light of India's escape from the oblivion of Babylon, Egypt and other mighty nations who were once her contemporaries. The Lord's answer clearly shows that a land lives, not by its material achievements, but in its masterpieces of man. Let the divine words be heard again, in this 20th century, twice dyed in blood a half over, no nation that can produce 10 men, great in the eyes of the unbribable judge, shall know extinction. Heeding such persuasions, India has proved herself not witless against the thousand cunnings of time. Self-realized masters in every century have hallowed her soil, modern Christ-like sages, like Lahiri Mahasaya and his disciple Sri Yukteswar, rise up to proclaim that the science of yoga is more vital than any material advances to man's happiness and to a nation's longevity. Very scanty information about the life of Lahiri Mahasaya and his universal doctrine has ever appeared in print. For 3 decades in India, America, and Europe, I have found a deep and sincere interest in his message of liberating yoga, a written account of the master's life, even as he foretold, is now needed in the West, where lives of the great modern yogis are little known. Nothing but 1 or 2 small pamphlets in English has been written on the guru's life. One biography in Bengali, Sri Sri Aishayamacharan Lahiri Mahasaya, appeared in 1941. It was written by my disciple, Swami Satyananda, who for many years has been the Acharya, spiritual preceptor, at Arvidyalaya in Ranchi. I have translated a few passages from his book and have incorporated them into this section devoted to Lahiri Mahasaya. It was into a pious Brahmin family of ancient lineage that Lahiri Mahasaya was born September 30, 1828. His birthplace was the village of Gurney in the Nadia district near Krishnagar, Bengal. He was the youngest son of Muktakashi, the second wife of the esteemed Gaur Mohan Lahiri. His first wife, after the birth of 3 sons, had died during a pilgrimage. The boy's mother passed away during his childhood. Little about her is known except the revealing fact that she was an ardent devotee of Lord Shiva, scripturally designated as the king of yogis. The boy Lahiri, whose given name was Shyamacharan, spent his early years in the ancestral home at Nadia. At the age of 3 or 4 he was often observed sitting under the sands in the posture of a yogi, his body completely hidden except for the head. The Lahiri estate was destroyed in the winter of 1833, when the nearby Jalangi River changed its course and disappeared into the depths of the Ganges. One of the Shiva temples founded by the Lahiris went into the river along with the family home. A devotee rescued the stone image of Lord Shiva from the swirling waters and placed it in a new temple, now well known as the Gurney Shiva site. Gaur Mohan Lahiri and his family left Nadia and became residents of Benares, where the father immediately erected a Shiva temple. He conducted his household along the lines of Vedic discipline, with regular observance of ceremonial worship, acts of charity, and scriptural study. Just and open-minded, however, he did not ignore the beneficial current of modern ideas. The boy Lahiri took lessons in Hindi and Urdu in Benares study groups. He attended a school conducted by Joy Narayan Gosal, receiving instruction in Sanskrit, Bengali, French, and English. Applying himself to a close study of the Vedas, the young yogi listened eagerly to scriptural discussions by learned Brahmins, including a Mahatta Pandit named Nagbhatta. Shyamacharan was a kind, gentle, and courageous youth, beloved by all his companions. With a well-proportioned, bright, and powerful body, he excelled in swimming and in many skillful activities. In 1846 Shyamacharan Lahiri was married to Srimati Kashi Moni, daughter of Sri Debnarayan Sanyal. A model Indian housewife, Kashi Moni cheerfully carried on her home duties and the traditional householder's obligation to serve guests and the poor. 2 saintly sons, Tinkori and Dukkori, blessed the union. At the age of 23, in 1851, Lahiri Mahasaya took the post of accountant in the military engineering department of the English government. He received many promotions during the time of his service. Thus not only was he a master before God's eyes, but also a success in the little human drama where he played his given role as an office worker in the world. As the offices of the Army Department were shifted, Lahiri Mahasaya was transferred to Ghazipur, Mirzapur, Danapur, Nainital, Benares, and other localities. After the death of his father, Lahiri had to assume the entire responsibility of his family, for whom he bought a quiet residence in the Garud's War Mohulla neighborhood of Benares. It was in his 33rd year that Lahiri Mahasaya saw fulfillment of the purpose for which he had been reincarnated on Earth. The ash-hidden flame, long smoldering, received its opportunity to burst into flame. A divine decree, resting beyond the gaze of human beings, works mysteriously to bring all things into outer manifestation at the proper time. He met his great guru, Babaji, near Aniket, and was initiated by him into Kriya Yoga. Ramu is raised from the dead. This auspicious event did not happen to him alone. It was a fortunate moment for all the human race, many of whom were later privileged to receive the soul awakening gift of Kriya. The lost, or long vanished, highest art of yoga was again being brought to light. Many spiritually thirsty men and women eventually found their way to the cool waters of Kriya Yoga. Just as in the Hindu legend, where Mother Ganges offers her divine draught to the parched devotee Bhagirath, so the celestial flood of Kriya rolled from the secret fastnesses of the Himalayas into the dusty haunts of men. Chapter 33. Babaji, the Yogi Christ of modern India. The northern Himalayan crags near Badrinagar are still blessed by the living presence of Babaji, guru of Lahiri Mahasaya. The secluded master has retained his physical form for centuries, perhaps for millenniums. The deathless Babaji is an avatara. This Sanskrit word means descent. Its roots are ava, down, and try, to pass. In the Hindu scriptures, avatara signifies the descent of divinity into flesh. Babaji's spiritual state is beyond human comprehension, Sri Yukteswar explained to me. The dwarfed vision of men cannot pierce to his transcendental star. One attempts in vain even to picture the avatar's attainment. It is inconceivable. The Upanishads have minutely classified every stage of spiritual advancement. A siddha, perfected being, has progressed from the state of a Jivanmukta, freed while living, to that of a Paramukta, supremely free, full power over death. The latter has completely escaped from the Mayic thraldom and its reincarnational round. The Paramukta therefore seldom returns to a physical body. If he does, he is an avatar, a divinely appointed medium of supernal blessings on the world. An avatar is unsubject to the universal economy. His pure body, visible as a light image, is free from any debt to nature. The casual gaze may see nothing extraordinary in an avatar's form, but it casts no shadow nor makes any footprint on the ground. These are outward symbolic proofs of an inward lack of darkness and material bondage. Such a God-man alone knows the truth behind the relativities of life and death. Omar Khayyam, so grossly misunderstood, sang of this liberated man in his immortal scripture, the Rubaiyat, "Ah, moon of my delight who knowest no wane. The moon of heaven is rising once again, how oft hereafter rising shall she look through this same garden after me in vain. The moon of delight is God, eternal Polaris, anachronous never. The moon of heaven is the outward cosmos, fettered to the law of periodic recurrence. Its chains had been dissolved forever by the Persian seer through his self-realization. How oft hereafter rising shall she look after me in vain. What frustration of search by a frantic universe for an absolute omission." Christ expressed his freedom in another way, and a certain scribe came, and said unto him, "Master, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest." And Jesus saith unto him, "The foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head." Spacious with omnipresence, could Christ indeed be followed except in the overarching spirit? Krishna, Rama, Buddha, and Patanjali were among the ancient Indian avatars. A considerable poetic literature in Tamil has grown up around Agastya, a South Indian avatar. He worked many miracles during the centuries preceding and following the Christian era, and is credited with retaining his physical form even to this day. Babaji's mission in India has been to assist prophets in carrying out their special dispensations. He thus qualifies for the scriptural classification of Mahavatar, Great Avatar. He has stated that he gave yoga initiation to Shankara, ancient founder of the Swami order, and to Kapiya, famous medieval saint. His chief 19th century disciple was, as we know, Lahiri Mahasaya, revivalist of the lost Kriya art. The Mahavatar is in constant communion with Christ, together they send out vibrations of redemption, and have planned the spiritual technique of salvation for this age. The Babaji, Yogi Christ of modern India, work of these two fully illumined masters, one with the body, and one without it, is to inspire the nations to forsake suicidal wars, race hatreds, religious sectarianism, and the boomerang evils of materialism. Babaji is well aware of the trend of modern times, especially of the influence and complexities of Western civilization, and realizes the necessity of spreading the self-liberations of yoga equally in the West and in the East. That there is no historical reference to Babaji need not surprise us. The great guru has never openly appeared in any century. The misinterpreting glare of publicity has no place in his millennial plans. Like the creator, the sole but silent power, Babaji works in a humble obscurity. Great prophets like Christ and Krishna come to earth for a specific and spectacular purpose. They depart as soon as it is accomplished. Other avatars, like Babaji, undertake work which is concerned more with the slow evolutionary progress of man during the centuries than with any one outstanding event of history. Such masters always veil themselves from the gross public gaze, and have the power to become invisible at will. For these reasons, and because they generally instruct their disciples to maintain silence about them, a number of towering spiritual figures remain world unknown. I give in these pages on Babaji merely a hint of his life, only a few facts which he deems it fit and helpful to be publicly imparted. No limiting facts about Babaji's family or birthplace, dear to the analyst's heart, have ever been discovered. His speech is generally in Hindi, but he converses easily in any language. He has adopted the simple name of Babaji, revered father. Other titles of respect given him by Lahiri Mahasaya's disciples are Mahamuni Babaji Maharaj, supreme ecstatic saint, Mahayogi, greatest of yogis, Trambak Baba and Shiva Baba, titles of avatars of Shiva. Does it matter that we know not the patronymic of an earth-released master? Whenever anyone utters with reverence the name of Babaji, Lahiri Mahasaya said, that devotee attracts an instant spiritual blessing. The deathless guru bears no marks of age on his body, he appears to be no more than a youth of 25. Fair-skinned, of medium build and height, Babaji's beautiful, strong body radiates a perceptible glow. His eyes are dark, calm, and tender, his long, lustrous hair is copper-colored. A very strange fact is that Babaji bears an extraordinarily exact resemblance to his disciple Lahiri Mahasaya. The similarity is so striking that, in his later years, Lahiri Mahasaya might have passed as the father of the youthful-looking Babaji. Swami Kabalananda, my saintly Sanskrit tutor, spent some time with Babaji in the Himalayas. The peerless master moves with his group from place to place in the mountains, Kabalananda told me. His small band contains two highly advanced American disciples. After Babaji has been in one locality for some time, he says, "Dear Danda Utal, let us lift our camp and staff." He carries a symbolic danda, bamboo staff. His words are the signal for moving with his group instantaneously to another place. He does not always employ this method of astral travel, sometimes he goes on foot from peak to peak. Babaji can be seen or recognized by others only when he so desires. He is known to have appeared in many slightly different forms to various devotees, sometimes without beard and mustache, and sometimes with them. As his undecaying body requires no food, the master seldom eats. As a social courtesy to visiting disciples, He occasionally accepts fruits, or ice cooked in milk and clarified butter. Two amazing incidents of Babaji's life are known to me, Kabbalananda went on. His disciples were sitting one night around a huge fire which was blazing for a sacred Vedic ceremony. The master suddenly seized a burning log and lightly struck the bare shoulder of Akila who was close to the fire. "Sir, how cruel!" Lahiri Mahasaya, who was present, made this remonstrance. "Would you rather have seen him burned to ashes before your eyes, according to the decree of his past karma?" With these words Babaji placed his healing hand on the Keela's disfigured shoulder. "I have freed you tonight from painful death. The karmic law has been satisfied through, Babaji, Yogi Christ of modern India, your slight suffering by fire." On another occasion Babaji's sacred circle was disturbed by the arrival of a stranger. He had climbed with astonishing skill to the nearly inaccessible ledge near the camp of the master. "Sir, you must be the great Babaji." The man's face was lit with inexpressible reverence. "For months I have pursued a ceaseless search for you among these forbidding crags. I implore you to accept me as a disciple." When the great guru made no response, the man pointed to the rocky chasm at his feet. "If you refuse me, I will jump from this mountain. Life has no further value if I cannot win your guidance to the divine." "Jump then," Babaji said unemotionally. "I cannot accept you in your present state of development." The man immediately hurled himself over the cliff. Babaji instructed the shocked disciples to fetch the stranger's body. When they returned with the mangled form, the master placed his divine hand on the dead man. "Lo!" He opened his eyes and prostrated himself humbly before the Omnipotent One. "You are now ready for discipleship." Babaji beamed lovingly on his resurrected Keela. "You have courageously passed a difficult test. Death shall not touch you again. Now you are one of our immortal flock." Then he spoke his usual words of departure. "Diradandayuto," the whole group vanished from the mountain. An avatar lives in the omnipresent spirit. For him there is no distance inverse to the square. Only one reason, therefore, can motivate Babaji in maintaining his physical form from century to century: the desire to furnish humanity with a concrete example of its own possibilities. Were man never vouchsafed a glimpse of divinity in the flesh, he would remain oppressed by the heavy maic delusion that he cannot transcend his mortality. Jesus knew from the beginning the sequence of his life. He passed through each event not for himself, not from any karmic compulsion, but solely for the upliftment of reflective, human beings. His four reporter disciples Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John recorded the ineffable drama for the benefit of later generations. For Babaji, also, there is no relativity of past, present, future. From the beginning he has known all phases of his life. Yet, accommodating himself to the limited understanding of men, he has played many acts of his divine life in the presence of one or more witnesses. Thus it came about that a disciple of Lahiri Mahasaya was present when Babaji deemed the time to be ripe for him to proclaim the possibility of bodily immortality. He uttered this promise before Rangopal Muzumdar, that it might finally become known for the inspiration of other seeking hearts. The great ones speak their words and participate in the seemingly natural course of events, solely for the good of man, even as Christ said, "Father, I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people which stand by I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me." During my visit at Ranbajpur with Ram Gopal, the sleepless saint, he related the wondrous story of his first meeting with Babaji. "I sometimes left my isolated cave to sit at Lahiri Mahasaya's feet in Benares," Rangopal told me. "One midnight as I was silently meditating in a group of his disciples, the master made a surprising request. Rangopal," he said, "go at once to the Dasasamade bathing ghat." I soon reached the secluded spot. The night was bright with moonlight and the glittering stars. After I had sat in patient silence for a while, my attention was drawn to a huge stone slab near my feet. It rose gradually, revealing an underground cave. As the stone remained balanced in some unknown manner, The draped form of a young and surpassingly lovely woman was levitated from the cave high into the air. Surrounded by a soft halo, she slowly descended in front of me and stood motionless, steeped in an inner state of ecstasy. She finally stirred, and spoke gently. "I am Mataji, the sister of Babaji.